We'll begin our discussion this evening by referring to what I believe is quite a well-known Rashi, and then perhaps raise a simple question and see what happens. The opening pasuk of Parshas Toldos, Ve'ele Toldos Yitzchak ben Avram, Avram holides Yitzchak, these are the generations or offspring of Yitzchak, i.e. Yaakov and Esav. Avram holides Yitzchak, Avram beget Yitzchak, and as we know, the pasuk seems to have said the same thing twice in two different ways. There's only two ways you can say it. Yitzhak was the son of Avram, and Avram was the father of Yitzhak. But that means that when you've said one, you've said it all. What is behind the repetition? And Rashi comments, Ayideisha kosav hakosuv Yitzhak ben Avram. Having said that Yitzhak is the son of Avram, huskak lomar Avram holides Yitzhak? Does one need to then say again, Avram holides Yitzchak, or perhaps one does. Why? Lefi shehayu leitzone hador, omrim, because the scoffers of the generation, which is actually maybe some form of comfort, there were leitzonim even back in those days. And what did they say? Me avimelech nisabra Sarah. They said, you know, Sarah, she's been married to Avram for so long, no matter children, and then she was taken by Avimelech, And then now she has a child, so maybe it's from Avimelech. Shari kama shanim shasayim Avram velonis Avrahimenu. She's been so long with Avram without a child. Even though to say such a thing, with the depth of the leitzonos, not only is it a hurtful thing to say to Avram, but essentially you're saying that Hashem was prepared to perform a miracle for the benefit of Avimelech, who's not really top on the list of who's who for righteousness, and not for Avram. But Leitzonim can basically say whatever they want. And they did. So Me'as HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so what did Hashem do? Tzar klaster ponav shel Yitzchak, domer la'Avram. He changed Yitzchak's facial features to form them to look like those of Avram. Ve'he'idu hakol, Avram holides Yitzchak. And that put the matter to rest. So the gossip columns on week two were followed up with breaking news about the change in the appearance of Yitzchak. I don't know if that would stop late on him nowadays, but it put the matter to rest then. So the interesting shaila is, we're at the beginning of Parshas Toldos. Currently, Yitzchak, as we will see, he's having children of his own. He's, as the pasuk itself says, 60 years, v'yitzchak ben shishim shana beledes osam. Therefore, the question is, why does the Torah only talk about this whole idea that was going round at this late juncture? I mean, he's 60 years old, a third of his life. Would it be not of more appropriate in Parshas Vayera when he's born? And presumably that's when the Leitzonim got going. I mean, they didn't wait 60 years. The Leitzonim don't wait that long. They don't have that long. So presumably it happened at the time. So why does the Torah not talk about it when Yitzchak is born, when this actual thing began to to make the rounds? And indeed, at least according to some Mefarshim, we see evidence of this idea of Leitzonei Hador, even when Yitzchak was born. The pasuk says that Avram, as we know, when Yitzchak was 2 years old, he made a mishte gadol. B'yom higa meles Yitzchak, when Yitzchak was weaned, Avram made a great feast. And the next pasuk says that Sarah saw Yishmael mitzachek, laughing. Now, the pasuk doesn't say what he was laughing about. But her response to that is to tell Avram to get rid of him. Except the question is, what's so bad about laughing? It's not such a terrible thing. But Rashi comments, of course, that sees within the word mitzachek terrible, terrible things, the beginnings of, if not more developed, forms of avodah zarah and gilui arayos and shvichus damim and terrible things. But the Sforno explains that mitzachek literally means laughing, and it was actually a terrible thing. Because he was laughing for the very same reason that the Leitzonei Hador were spreading their rumors. Namely, that Sarah had Yitzchak from Avimelech. And what's the joke? The joke is, if it's not really Avram's son, but it's funny that Avram is making this great feast for him, and Yishmael found that funny. And that's what he was laughing. So, interestingly, the Sforno understands Mitzachet literally as laughing, but it was its own very terrible type of crying, because essentially it is delegitimizing Yitzchak. That is not acceptable. And moreover, that's why she said that Yishmael has to go. For everyone else, it's just a bit of a joke. But for Yishmael, it's deadly serious. Because really what he's saying is that if Yitzchak is not the son of Avram, then Yishmael is his primary son. And that's really what it's about. And Sarah says he can't stay here with that platform. And indeed, as the Aruch Laner, Rabbi Yaakov Etlinger in his drushes points out, Sarah says, Garesh ha'ama hazoz ve'espana. She says, you have to get rid of Hagar, you have to get rid of Yishmael. As the pasuk continues, Ki lo yirash ben ha'ama hazoz im b'ni im Yitzhak, for he will not inherit together with Yitzhak. And I think the way we normally approach those words is this is Sarah's still maintaining, demanding that he not inherit together with Yitzhak. Ki lo yirash, send him away, that he not inherit together with Yitzhak. But the Aruch Laner says, given what Yishmael was saying and was laughing about, what it means to say is that he himself will not be prepared to inherit together with Yitzhak. He'll claim everything for himself, because that's really what he's saying. Interestingly, as a follow-up, we do find in the end of last week's Parsha, Chazal, the Gemara in Bava Basra, a comment that Yishmael did tshuva. Rashi quotes it. It's an interesting thing. The end, he did tshuva. But where do we see that Yishmael did tshuva? Because when Avram died and they buried him, so the pasuk says, "Vayikberu oso Yitzchak v'Yishmael banav." Yitzchak and Yishmael buried Avram. But the point is, Yitzchak is mentioned first, and the idea is that Yishmael allowed him to go first. And from here, you see, says the Gemara, that Yishmael did tshuva. Interestingly, and worthwhile pointing out, I'm not sure that it's that well known, because there is another opinion which is not to be found, not mentioned in Rashi. Rashi's job is not to mention every opinion in Chazal. But Rabbi Kiva Eger points out in his glosses to Maseches Sanhedrin, that there appears to be a machlokus as to whether Yishmael did tshuva. And how do we see that? On the one hand, you have this Gemara in Bava Basra, quoted by Rashi. You see, Yitzhak went first, Yishmael allowed him to go first, that means he did tshuva, and that's what Rashi records. But the Gemara elsewhere, in Sanhedrin, I think it's Adaf Kuf Dalet, has a comment, Bra mezake abba. A child can give schus to the father. Ve'ein abba mezake bra. But the father can't give schus to the child, which is itself interesting, because we have a concept called schus avos, so how does that exactly work together? But the Gemara gives an example. Avram cannot help Yishmael. The father can't help the child. He can't give his zechuyos to his child. So Rabbi Kiva Eger, but Yishmael doesn't need help. I mean, not by this stage. Didn't he do tshuva? Apparently, whoever is behind that statement in Sanhedrin understands that Yishmael did not do tshuva. And therefore, he's without merit. And the point of the Gemara is, and Avram's merits will not help him. But be that as it may, the question which one may ask, a balabatish, a shayla, how do we see from the fact that Yishmael allowed Yitzchak to bury Avram before him that he did tshuva? That doesn't represent a whole change in direction of life. Maybe he had a moment of courtesy. Maybe he doesn't like burying people. So at least Yitzchak go first. But the point is, says Meshech Chochma, when we understand exactly what was behind his primary crime was to completely delegitimize Yitzchak as Avram's son. That was the problem. If he's still held by that, there is no way that he would then allow Yitzchak to be involved in the burying of Avram before himself. By allowing Yitzchak to go first, what he's saying is that you have primacy in terms of giving this final covet to Avram, because you are the primary son. That's tshuva from his original laughter of Leitzani Hador. But what we do see is, therefore, that this idea was around for a while. The Leitzanim were active from the beginning, in which case the question comes back, how come the Torah does not indicate this idea to us until Pashas Toldos, when Yitzhak is much, much older? And the Al-Sheikh HaKadosh says something very interesting. And even Leitzanim, they understand that they need a certain basis of credibility to really get going. I mean, they can say what they want, but as long as they don't have a leg to stand on, then no one pays attention. And therefore, when Yitzhak is born, it's a miracle. They start to say it, but no one pays attention to them, because why would they? Because two alternatives, Avram and Avimelech, which do we vote most likely that Yitzhak came from? It's a miracle child. It's going to be Avram. And therefore, their traction and their impact was limited. All that changed in the beginning of Parshas Toldos, because that's when Yitzhak had two children. One of them is Yaakov, which is very nice. One of them is Esav, which is not very nice. And it was known quite from the beginning that this child, I mean, no one really knows what to make of him. And this is where the Leitzone Hador, now they made a comeback. This was their finest hour, because they were now able to say, you see, that's what we've been saying. No one listened to us. No one believed us. But if indeed Yitzchak is the son of Avram and Sarah, so how do you figure that he can have a child like Esav? It's got to be that Esav comes from lesser roots, and that's Avimelech, like we were saying. So the full depth of the mockery here is that actually their leitzonus is in the guise of respect for Avram. That's the irony here, as if to say, it can't be from Avram, because Avram was such a tzaddik, how could someone like Esav come from him? And therefore, the arithmetic now, given they have such high regard for Avram, is that Avram isn't the father, which means that Leitzonus will enlist whatever it takes in order to get to the point it wants to get to. Avram is a great tzaddik equals Avram is not the father. And that's why the pasuk talks about it here. It appears from the Al Sheikh, and I don't believe he says this explicitly, but what put to rest the claims of the Leitzone Hador was Hashem changing Yitzhak's features to look like Avram. Apparently, the Al-Sheikh is saying that actually happened when Yitzhak was 60 years old, because this is when they really gained voice and gained momentum, and when it had to be responded to, which is quite different. I think we normally picture Yitzhak when he was really just at the beginning, was changed to look like Avram. From the Al-Sheikh, it seems like this is where it resurfaced with Beyeser Seis Beyeser Oz, with much greater potency, and this is when the matter was put to rest. So Yitzhak underwent a change of appearance at the age of 60. So it appears. But what we do see, and this is very interesting, and it's more of a general parshanut theme to be detected, is that the Torah does not always, or more correctly, as a rule, as soon as something happens, the Torah will talk about it. But sometimes the Torah will wait, so to speak. It will wait until it appears with its maximum potency. And where it is most pronounced, that's where it will get its reference in the Torah. And our case is just such an example. So these are some comments. Again, the Rashi, as I said, is well known. Leitzone Hador and Avraham and Yitzhak. But as is always, there's quite a bit to say within the Rashi itself. Now, I'd like to move from there to actually discuss a question in this week's Parsha. But again, it's rooted in last week's Parsha. How so? If we look at Perek Kaf Dalet, Pasuk Lamites. Perek Haftalit Pasuk Lamites. And we are back in Eliezer, and he's telling the story to Rivka's family. And Avram said, I've got to come to the family, as we discussed last week. And then Pasuk Lamites reads, Va'omar el Adonai. And I said to my master, Ulayla telecha isha acharai. Maybe she won't come after me. What should I do? Should I bring Yitzhak there? And Avram said no. But focusing on the question itself, Ulayla telecha isha acharai. Maybe she will not follow me back. Rashi has an interesting comment. The word ulai, Rashi notes, elai ksiv. It's written without a vav. As if to say that ulai, which translates, if you read it that way, it translates maybe, but elai translates to me, which means maybe is to me. How so? Bas haysalo le'Eliezer. Because Eliezer had a daughter, and therefore he felt that maybe he was in the running. He's not plan A, but maybe he can be plan B. And he was looking for some type of opening, some type of way that Avram might turn his attention to him. Avram said, no, sorry. Amalo Avram, b'ni baruch, v'ata oror, v'ein oror, medabik b'baruch. Cannot be. My son is blessed. You're cursed. Blessed and cursed doesn't go together. And even in the shidduch business, that's taken as a no. Now, what's interesting is Rashi understands that this idea comes from the fact that the word ulai is written without a vav. Ulai is eila. He states that explicitly. But the Vilna Gaon states that actually the idea of the medrash, that Eliezer had a daughter and he wanted Yitzhak maybe to marry his daughter, it actually comes from the word ulai itself. It's not about being with a vav missing, with a vav, without a vav. It's from the word ulai itself. How so? Says the Gaon, as we know, whenever there are two words in Lashon HaKodesh which have roughly the same meaning, they never have exactly the same meaning. There is no such thing as a synonym in the pure sense of the word, according to the Vilna Gaon, in Lashon HaKodesh. If there's two words for the same thing, it's because it's not the same thing. It's the same type of thing, but there is yet a difference. And therefore, with that background, we note that there are two words in Lashon HaKodesh which denote something that might happen. And they are ulai and pen. And they both are possibilities. Not certainties, but possibilities. What is the difference between them? Well, says the Vilna Gaon, when a person is considering something that might happen, there are two attitudes towards that thing happening. He may wish for that thing to happen, or he may wish for that thing not to happen. And that is the difference between ulai and pen. Ulai is optimistic. I hope this happens. That's what ulai means. Pen is pessimistic, in the, or more correctly in the sense that this is something that I hope does not happen. It has a negative relationship with that outcome. And indeed, I believe this is reflected, but in the way that we translate the word pen, we don't translate the word pen as maybe. We translate it as lest. And lest always is really something that we hope will not happen. And therefore, says Vilna Gaon, consider. If, in fact, Eliezer had no interest, that is to say, interests within the situation, then he should hope that she'll come back. And hope that she won't refuse. But if that's the case, then he should have said, Pen lo telecha ishach, all right? Lest she might not come. It could be that she won't happen. I hope it doesn't happen, but we have to talk about it, because maybe it will. What should I do then? But because Eliezer did not say pen le telecha isha, but rather ulai le telecha isha, that revealed that actually, when he was voicing this possibility, it was something that he hoped would happen. I hope, and not perhaps not so close to the surface or so overtly, but part of him hoped that she wouldn't come back. I hope this doesn't happen. But why would you hope it wouldn't happen? Because he had someone else he wanted to marry, Yitzhak, his daughter. That's where it comes from. So you see, says the Gaon, it's really from the Lashon HaKodesh of the word ulai, not so much, well, as to say, different than Rashi, that it's about ulai written without a vav. That's a classic explanation of the Vilna Gaon. Now, what does this have to do with us? We're in Parshas Toldos. Because there are two classic questions that are raised by later Mefarshim about this idea of the Vilna Gaon, and the first is from our Parsha. How so? In Perek Kaf Zayin, Pasuk Yud Beis. So we're already in the leading towards the Brachos. Rivka wants Yaakov to get the Brachos. And Yaakov says, there's a problem. Vayomer Yaakov and Rivka imo, Hein Esav achi, this pasuk yud aleph, Hein Esav achi ish sa'ir. Esav, my brother, so he is peri, vanochi ish chalak, and I'm smooth. Ulai umusheni avisa, what will happen if my father feels me, and then it will be up, and then he'll curse me and won't bless me? He had to mention it. It could happen. So So the Mefarshim ask, according to the Vilna Gaon, why is Yaakov using the word ulai? He's actually predicting a disastrous outcome, or at least mentioning the notion of such a thing. Surely it's something he doesn't want it to be cursed. He doesn't want this thing to happen. It might, but why is he expressing it with ulai, which sounds like it's that he would like this to happen? It's an interesting shaila. The words of the Vilna Gaon are taken with utmost seriousness. Later Mefarshim, they comb through the Chumash, and if something doesn't check out, they raise the question. And in fact, they comb through the entire Tanakh, because the second question comes from Ksuvim, from Sefer Iyov. The beginning of Sefer Iyov, I think we normally just move into the suffering and wonder what it's all about, and then close Sefer Iyov. But Perek Aleph of Iyov has as much discussion about what Iyov's life was like before things got difficult. And the Pasuk says that he had many children, and it describes how his children, when they would have these parties every night. And Iyov was quite suspect as to what those parties were like, to the extent that he would offer a korban every morning because in case something went wrong, he wants to be mechaper for his children, back to parents and children. And he would say, the pasuk says he would bring a korban, because he would say, ulai chotu banai, maybe my children sinned, ubercho elokim belibam, maybe they had untoward thoughts towards Hashem or religion generally. So he'd bring a korban. So the Mefarshim ask, ulai chotu banai? You want that to happen? Why are you bringing a korban? You don't want it to happen. It should have said, "Pen chatu banai." These are the two questions on the Vilna Gaon's thesis of the difference between ulai and pen. Yaakov Avinu, ulai yumusheni avi, and Iyov, ulai chatu banai. Those are the questions. Well, each question has its answer or answers. With regards to Yaakov, al Rishon Rishon, with regards to Yaakov, so the Mefarshim say either that, in a sense, Yaakov, as we know, has very mixed feelings about this whole thing. And although Yaakov is asked to perpetrate a deception of sorts, but he's not a deceptive person. The Pasuk says he's Ish Tam, Yoshev Ahalim. Later on, we'll say, Titan Emes Li Yaakov. So his midah is emes. He's asked really to depart for this, for a higher cause, and by a higher person called Rivka, but it's not something that he is fully at ease with, nor should it be. And therefore, some Mefarshim say that ulai musheni avi, although it will spell disaster for the whole thing, because if his father feels him and knows that he's not really Esav, then the game is up and he might end up being cursed, but there's still something within Yaakov that hopes that will happen, because that's the truth. And the truthful part of Yaakov, which is all of Yaakov really, is really tending towards that, even though it will be the undoing of everything that Rivka is saying. It, almost in spite of himself, he's saying, I hope that the truth comes out. That's one possibility. Or the second answer which is given is perhaps more al derech ha-parshanut. Yaakov does hope that Yitzhak will feel him. Not because he will then discover that he was Esav, that's the undoing of the whole thing, but as a prelude to the brachos, as we know. It's a very important part of the bestowing of a bracha that some contact be formed through the one giving the bracha and the one receiving the bracha. They need to be connected with each other in order for the bracha to go through. Sometimes it's enough for one to see the other, and that's why you always find that, for example, when if a bracha or lehabdil klala, when Bilam was asked to curse the people, he needed to see them to curse them. If one can see someone else, he can give them a bracha. Yitzchak can't see. Vayihiki zachin Yitzchak vatichena inav meraos. And therefore Yaakov says, I hope to get the brachas. And as part of getting the brachas, Yitzchak will need to establish some type of direct contact with me. He can't see me, which means I hope that he will feel me in order to give the brachas. The problem is, if he does, he'll know that I'm not Esav. And therefore, the ulai, it doesn't cover the entire disastrous outcome, but it covers at least that first part where I hope he gives me the bracha, but in so doing, he'll need to feel me. Hence, ulai yumusheni avi. So these are the two answers given for the ulai with regards to Yaakov's words, ulai yumusheni avi. And with regards to Iyov, Ulai Chotu Bonai, it doesn't sound like it's the sort of thing that he would want them to do. Why does he use a want them to do word? Which is Ulai, you should have said pen. Well, Mefarshim say, if you look at Iyov's words, he says, Ulai Chotu Bonai, and maybe something's happened, Uberchu Elokim Belibam, and maybe they've had untoward thoughts. So Mefarshim say, untoward thoughts are not good, but they're better than untoward actions. As if to say, it's almost like the lesser of two evils. Eov says, I hope it's not that bad. I hope that it's just that. Even that needs kapara. But hopefully it didn't go further than that. That's what he means to say. And therefore the ulai of Chotu Banai is not on the chait, but that the chait is limited to that which is in their hearts, as opposed to unacceptable behavior. And that's why within those possibilities, Eov chooses the mildest of the negative outcomes and says about that. Ulai. So these are the answers that are provided for the questions that are raised on the Vilna Gaon in the difference between pen and ulai. It's worthwhile mentioning, having opened the question of pen and ulai, just as a counterpoint, shall we say, the Sefer Divrei Shaul, which was written by Rav Yosef Shaul Halevi Natanson, he's famous of Lvov. He was the author of the Tshuvas, Shelos Tshuvas Shaul Meshiv, one of the great poskim of the 1800s. And he has a sefer on Chumash, more than one volume, in fact, called Divrei Shaul. And he discusses Ulai versus Pen, and he rather suggests that Ulai and Pen is not so much how one feels about something, as if to say, does he hope it will happen, equals Ulai, or does he hope it won't happen, equals Pen. But rather, it's more an assessment of the likelihood of whether or not it will happen. Ulai represents something that is likely to happen. It probably will. Pen, it probably won't, but maybe it will. That's the difference between them. Ulai is probably yes, and pen is probably no, but you never know. And therefore, with regards to, interesting, just pulling back now to Eliezer, according to this, what Eliezer is saying is, Ulai lo tiva, it's quite likely that she won't want to come. I mean, she's being asked to travel to another country. I mean, people didn't really do that just to get married to someone they hadn't seen. It probably won't happen. Ulai lo telecha isha acharai. Similarly, Yaakov in our parsha says, Ulai Mosheni avi. Certainly, as per our discussion before, he will probably feel me as a prelude to the bracha. But then what? Hence, ulai. And similarly, Eov, it's not something he wants to happen, but he feels, given the nature of those parties that were going on, ulai, this probably happened, hence he needs to bring a kapara. So these are ideas really to bear in mind now as we go throughout Chumash. You see an ulai and you see a pen, you know, to be alert, right? Each one has its own meaning, its own flavor, and its own color in terms of what it says about the situation. So these are some comments with regards to the prelude to the brachos, but of course the center of that section of the parsha are the brachos themselves. And let us devote now some time to having a look at those brachos. And we'll begin at the end, for reasons that I hope will be apparent, in Perek Kaf Zayin, Posag Lamed Vav, when Esav has discovered that Yaakov has gotten the better of him once again. Perek Kaf Zayin, Pasuk Lamed Vav. Vayomer. I mean, this was not a good day for Esav. Vayomer, hachi karashmer Yaakov. It was apt that he called him Yaakov. Vayakveni zepamayim. He's deceived me. He's gotten one over me twice now. Look at what he's done to me. And Esav lists his woes. Es bechora sila kach, he took my bechora. Avinei atal kach bechos, he took my brachas now. Right, so Yaakov is Yaakov by name, Yaakov by nature. He keeps on getting the better of me. He took my bechora, and now he took my brachas. Now, what's interesting is, how does Esav feel about the fact that Yaakov took his bechora? Don't forget, at the time, Esav was not concerned about this at all. We know Esav's reaction. Vayivez Esav as a bechore. He scorned the bechore. It was nothing for him. So he didn't really feel that he'd lost. He'd gained. He gained a bowl of soup and lost nothing. And for him, it was a fair trade. So he didn't really feel that Yaakov had really gotten the better. As far as he's concerned, maybe he thought that he'd gotten the better of Yaakov. Yaakov took this worthless thing and I got a nice bowl of lentils for it. And all of a sudden, we never find him complain about this. But we see that apparently it's been bothering him. And it comes out. You see, all those years ago, he took my bechora. I don't know. I mean, they were 15 years old when he sold the bechora. They're currently 63. That's 48 years. 48 years is a long time. Even not in politics. So to have it, it's like a delayed reaction. He just now discovered that Yaakov got the better of him. Never occurred to him before. When he then proceeds to ask Yitzhak, do you have anything left? Is there anything left? And he's wailing. And then Yitzhak says, you know, okay, there's something left. Here it is. And that's in Pasuk Lamed Dalet. Vayan Yitzchak Avi Vayomer Elav. Hine Mishmanei Haaretz Yemer Shavecha. You will dwell with the fat of the land. Umitala Shemai Me'al. From the dew of the heavens. Now, what's interesting is this pasuk, that the leftover bracha, so to speak, that Yitzchak gives to Esav, is very similar to the bracha that he gave to Yaakov. It's almost word for word. For to Yaakov, he says, "V'itenach Elokim mital haShemayim mishmanei haaretz." And what does he say to Esav? I'm sorry, there's almost nothing left. Maybe there's nothing left until Esav pushes him, and Yitzchak says, "Okay, you know what? There is something left. Tal haShemayim mishmanei haaretz." So how could he give that to Esav when he's already given it to Yaakov? And why did he originally say that there was nothing left? Now, there is a very interesting comment, somewhat enigmatic, that the Medrash makes on Pasuk Tes of Perek Kaf Zayin. Pasuk Tes. This is when Rivka tells Yaakov to, she enlists him and gets the whole thing going. She says, Lechnar Latzon, go to the flock, Vekach li misham, and take from me from there, Shnei Gida'ei Izim Tovim. Two good goat kids. Ve'er sosamatamim lavicha kashohev, and I'll cook them the way that your father likes them. And the Medrash is very, focuses on the word Tovim. Shnei Gida'ei Izim. Tovim. Good kids, good goats. Good in what way? Well, presumably that means that they're good and healthy. But the Medrash says, Tovim, they're very good. Tovim lecha, good for you, but Tovim levanecha, good for your descendants. That's very good. But in what does that mean? How are they good? And how does this goodness express itself? Says the Medrash, Tovim lecha, they're good for you, because through them you'll get the brachas. That's good. But they're also good for your children, because your children will have their own version of two goats. And Rivka, says the Medrash, is referring or alluding to none other than the two goats of Yom Kippur, which bring kapara to Bnei Yisrael. That's how good they are. That's Tovim. Tovim lecha, v'tovim levanecha. Tovim lecha, she'al yodam atam mekabel es habrachos, v'tovim levanecha, she'ayodam yiskapru. They'll get kapara. But the question, of course, is what is the connection between the two goats through which Yaakov gets his brachos and the two goats which later on in history become the Shnei Se'irim? They're both two sets of goats, but they have no connection to each other. They're doing something completely different. And so how are they? How is one a continuum or even related to the other? And this question is discussed by the Beis HaLevi. And to give a background to his approach here, says Beis HaLevi, if you look at the pasuk, it's quite clear that Yaakov is not interested in getting the brachas. Rivka has her own ideas. And in the end, he submits. But of his own, he would never go and get the brachas. But that's unusual. He doesn't seem to be bothered by the fact that he's not getting the brachas. He doesn't want them. Rivka has to convince him. But why doesn't he want them? And in the Medrash, it's even more explicit. The Medrash describes him going. He's crying as he's going to his father to get the brachas. I mean, what's so terrible about getting brachas? It's not just because he thinks it won't work. He doesn't really want the brachas themselves. And says Beis HaLevi, to a large degree, I understand him completely. Because the primary understanding of what the brachas are, if you read the psukim, and there are midrashim, but if you read the psukim, it's about material well-being. I mean, mitala shamayim mishmane ha'aretz. It's about living goodness in this world. Says Beis HaLevi, material well-being is not always the best thing for the Jewish people. The Jewish people are not always at their most Jewish when they're prospering materially. It doesn't always bring out the most Jewish aspects of them. As the Pasuk itself says, Pentocha v'savata, things are well for you, v'shachachta s'ashem elokecha, v'ram levavecha, v'yishman yishurin v'yivat. I mean, we don't look for difficulties, but it is true that an easy life and what sometimes can be distracting, it can become its own value, and people can drift away from things that are really tachlis. When Yaakov says, I'm ish chalak, I'm smooth, as if to say, and therefore I'm not the one for the brachas, the Medrash says, what is the meaning of chalak? Yaakov ki chelek Hashem amo. It associates the word chalak with chelek. I belong to Hashem, and I want to continue to belong to Hashem. I don't want to belong to matters of this world that might divert my focus. And moreover, says Beis HaLevi, that's the very reason why Yitzhak doesn't want to give the brachas to Yaakov. He has every good wish for Yaakov, but he doesn't think that these are good for Yaakov. He knows. Although Rashi at the beginning of the Parsha, Esav is able to fool Yitzchak, but not completely. You see, Rashi himself says that when Esav comes back and says, Esav asks him, well, it's really Yaakov, and therefore Yitzchak says, how come you're back so soon? And Yaakov, with a slip of the tongue, says, Hashem helped me. And Yitzchak just had to hear those words, and he's like, something's up here. And then is it really him? He was suspicious hearing Hashem's name from the person who seemed to be Esav. That doesn't seem to go well with the Rosh Hashiva facade that Esav had been cultivating. That means that Yitzhak fundamentally knows who Yaakov is. He may think Esav is trying, but he knows that Esav is really the Olam Hazeh personality here and not Yaakov. And therefore, he has these brachas to give, and they're not for Yaakov, they're for Esav. So we understand basically everyone in the equation. I understand Yaakov, he doesn't want them. I understand Yitzhak, he doesn't want to give them to Yaakov. So the only one left to understand is the one who takes a contrary approach to all of the above. And that's Rivka. And Rivka says, no, Yaakov should get the brachas. How does she see things? And in fact, the question really is twofold. Number one, why does she judge that these brachas are good for Yaakov? And secondly, if we may ask, says Beis HaLevi, one has to say it in the right way, but they don't really seem to have worked been fulfilled. Not in the way that we would expect. Because the Jewish people are not always, I mean, they make their mark and they have their moments, but as an ongoing situation, they're not always on top of matters in the Olam Hazeh. Sometimes they're at the bottom. Sometimes the Olam Hazeh is on top of them. And even Yaakov, he's criticized for saying this on his level. But when asked for Paro, how old he was, Yaakov says, you know, I had a hard life. That's why I look so old. I had a hard life. Now, whether or not it was correct for him to say that, but he said it because it was true. Whatever happened to the brachas? Don't the brachas, shouldn't that give him easy existence? Says Beis HaLevi, Rivka had a very specific goal in Yaakov getting the brachas. More correctly, two goals. Her goal was twofold. There are two areas, says Beis Halev, if we really boil it down, there are two areas where material prosperity are of benefit for the Jewish people, for opposite reasons, as we'll see. The first is it gives them the opportunity to perform mitzvahs, right, should they so desire. Nothing stops them. They have everything they need in order to live a Torah lifestyle. They'll never want for the wherewithal to fulfill mitzvahs properly. That's an asset. I mean, they have to want to do that, but if they do, that's an asset. Secondly, says Beis Halevi, there is great value in matters of this world belonging to the Jewish people, or to Yaakov, and then by extension to the Jewish people. Why? They don't always enjoy them. But if they own them, so there's an amazing comment of the Gemara in Maseches Bava Basra and Daf Yud. Those Dapim there, Tes and Yud, they're about Stocker, matters of Stocker. And the Gemara quotes the Pasuk, V'noksayich Tzedakah. Noksayich, those that oppress you. It's Tzedakah. What does that mean? What it means is, says the Gemara, any money that's yours and is then extorted from you by your oppressors is the equivalent of Tzedakah. It's a kapara, that is to say. It's yours, but it was taken away. V'noksayich, those that oppress you and they take your money away, that's Tzedakah money. And that is, therefore, in a sense, it's almost like an ongoing kapara for the Jewish people, the fact that they're not able to enjoy assets that, in principle, are really theirs. That's tzedakah for them on an ongoing basis. And tzedakah is a great asset. That wouldn't be true if they didn't really own any matters of Olam Hazeh. It would just have nothing to do with them. And therefore, should we ask, did Rivka succeed? She did. Because if we come back to our earlier point, that the bracha that Yitzhak gave to Esav, that leftover bracha, was almost identical to the bracha that he gave to Yaakov in the first place. Almost, but not exactly the same. The difference is, they're both blessed with material prosperity. The difference between them is, for one of them, it is given to him, and the other, it says that he will enjoy it. Isn't that the difference between them? With regards to Yaakov, it says, "V'yitenacha, Hashem will give to you, mitala shemaim mishmanei aretz," because the material prosperity of this world, it belongs to you, it will be given to you. Amazingly, there's still room for a bracha to Esav, which says, "Mitala shemaim yemoshavecha, mishmanei aretz yemoshavecha, mitala shemaim," you'll have it. So whose is it? Is it Yaakov's? Was it given to Yaakov? Was it given to Esav? Yaakov owns it, but Esav enjoys it. And that is exactly what Rivka wants. She doesn't want Yaakov to have all that prosperity. It might not even be good for him, but it's good for him to have it. Because if Esav takes it from him, v'noksayach tzedakah, that is an ongoing source of merit for Yaakov. And with this in mind, says the Beis Halevi, we can understand, it's on the most subtle level, why the Medrash made that association of the two goats of Yaakov himself with the two goats of Yom Kippur. Because when you think about it, what happens with those two goats of Yom Kippur is essentially another iteration of the two goats that came to Yaakov, and why the brachos came to Yaakov. Namely, Yaakov received the brachos, which means, number one, he has material prosperity at his disposal should he choose to use it for mitzvahs, for matters of avodas Hashem. But it also might be taken from him, which is also a source of merit. Good for him in those two ways. Two goats, two benefits. And the very same benefit is what we find in the two goats of Yom Kippur every year. How so? Because the first goat becomes Korban Lashem. As if to say, it's an asset and it's used for a mitzvah. That's like the first benefit for Yaakov. And what about the second goat? Sa'ir Lazazel, sent away. It's sent away to, and that's a kapara. It doesn't become part of the avoda. It gets cast away, just like Yaakov's assets could get cast away into Esav's domain, and that's a kapara. And that's the depth of the connection between Tovim Lecha, Yaakov, and Tovim Levanecha. So Rivka succeeded. And everyone's happy, except for Esav. Esav is not happy. And moreover, his unhappiness is twofold. As he says, he took my bechora, and now he took my brachas. And our question was, there was no love lost on the bechora when it happened. I mean, that's 48 years ago. How come you're suddenly bothered about it now? But the reason is because Esav has a certain reason for parting with the avoda in general and at that time. As if to say, the Bechora represents primarily, and that's how Rashi explains it and others, the Avoda, the Bechora represents primacy in matters of serving Hashem. Well, Esav isn't really that interested. He's not going to give it away, but he's not that interested in keeping it. But at a certain point, he wanted to give it away. There's an amazing comment of the Medrash about how Esav reacted to the news of Avram's death on that day, because that was the day that Avram died. There 15, Avram is 175. By Yazid Yaakov Nazid. Yaakov is baking those lentils. That's a Suda of Evil. And Esav, who's been oblivious to all of this, he hasn't really been checking in with the family, but he's been hunting, he's been doing whatever. But he comes home, and everyone's been Evil. And Esav says, what's happening here? To which they say, well, Avram died. And the Medrash says, when Esav heard that Avram died, he said, Avram is dead? So there can be no justice in the world, you know, I don't believe in anything. And he threw the whole thing in and was prepared to part with his Bechora. So Beis Halevi says, I mean, you have to understand, what's behind that reaction? Okay, Avram died, it's a sad occasion, but did you think he'd live forever? You can't get over it. You never would have thought that Avram would have died. And as soon as he did, you take that as a sign that no one's in charge of the world, and I throw the whole thing in. I mean, where is that reaction coming from? So Beis Halevi says, it was not a spontaneous reaction. It was a calculated reaction. Avram has begun a legacy which will become the Jewish people. And it is already known that whoever is part of the Jewish people will undergo, in the near future, difficult times. And we know that that is the Brismen of Besari. Kigeri Azarecha, Beres Elohem, Va'avadum, Ve'inu Osam. They're going to have a very difficult time. It's part of how they will be formed as a nation. And Esav is not interested in that. But it is also known that none of this will start until Avram dies. Hashem said, you will die peacefully, meaning none of the, as Rashi says, none of this will start in your days. Which means that as long as Avram is alive, Esav doesn't have to worry that keeping the Bechora will bring with it any notion that he may have to undergo those difficulties. Because nothing will happen as long as Avram's alive. As soon as Avram dies, now at any time, whoever is his heir, in terms of his legacy, stands to be the one that goes through all of that exile, and Esav doesn't want. But who is that forecast for? Geriyeh Zarecha. The idea of Zarecha, that is this, and we already know that Yishmael was cast aside. He's not considered to be Zera Avram. He's exited the program. Whoever's in the category of Zera Avram, a descendant of Avram, in the full sense of the word, stands to undergo these difficulties. Esav doesn't want to do that. But how can he get out of it? By removing himself from the category of Zera Avram. But how does he do that? By repudiating everything that Avram stands for. In other words, the point here, which we find so often, is that the notion of that the relationship between one's beliefs and the way one wishes to live life the notion that, that belief leads to the way one wishes to lead life, as if to say, first one discovers what one thinks is true. And then given what one believes to be true, that will then dictate the course one takes in life. That's very often the opposite of the truth. In so many ways, in so many spheres, one first starts by saying, well, if I believe that, where will it take me? And if it takes you to a place that is not convenient for you, or not pleasant for you, so the reaction is very simple, the response is very simple. Oh, so I don't believe it. Because I can't afford to believe it. Because if I do, I'll go into exile. So on the one hand, in the purest terms, the idea of belief shouldn't be subject to these things. It's belief is a function of whether it's true or not. But belief and truth are very often the last thing to be brought into line. Because the first question is, where will this take me? Where is this leading? Is it leading to a comfortable existence? Then I believe it. And if it's leading to an uncomfortable existence, it is not convenient for me to believe this to be true anymore. Hence, I've stopped believing it and out I go. As if to say, Aesop's response of I don't believe in anything anymore, it wasn't that he was so impacted by Avram. He was never so close to Avram. But the point is, it is a calculated decision. It's time to bail for Aesop. He can't afford to believe anymore because already now it's in the offing to go into Golos. And therefore Aesop says, it was nice being the Bechor for the first 15 years because there were no strings attached and none of this could potentially happen. I don't want to be the Bechor anymore. I don't want to think that those things are true anymore because thereby, by their doing, I'm out and I want to be out. And therefore he was very happy to part with the Bechor at that time. Because essentially what he's saying is to Yaakov, you know, between us, you take the Avram side of things and you take the more spiritual side of things with all that goes with that. And I guess that means you're going into Golos and good luck to you. And I'll take the rest. I'll take the comfortable existence. And if that's okay with you, it's okay with me. And he belittled the Bechorah. He had no time for it. But all of that changed now. Why? Because he discovered that Yaakov had just now received the brachos of Olam Hazeh as well. At this point, Esav now looks back at the Bechorah and says, I would not have parted with it so easily, because he's left me with nothing. As long as the division was clear, that he takes matters of Ruchnius, let's say, and I'll take matters of Gashmius, so then to each his own, and I was okay with that. But he seems to have taken the Gashmius also, so now I'm not even happy about him having taken the Ruchnius in the first place. And that's why it's not so much a delayed reaction, it is a retrospective reaction, which has now surfaced when he realized that Yaakov really got the better of him in both ways. And these are then the comments of the Beis Halevi to understand why it was that he only began to regret to having sold the Bechorah when he realized not only did he lose the Bechorah and in his estimation would be in line for the Brachos, he lost the Brachos as well. And that's how it ends with Esav. It's fascinating to consider, just in conclusion, how the Parsha of Toldos ends. If you ever look at the final Epsukim, Yaakov has Yitzchak has sent Yaakov away. Do not take from the Berut Kanani. Yaakov goes away. Pasuk Ches of Perikav Ches. Vayar Esav ki ra'os benot Kanan. He sees the daughters of Kanan. They're evil. Be'ena Yitzchak aviv in Yitzchak's eyes. So what does he do? Vayelech Esav al Yishmael. So he goes to Yishmael. Everything's relative. Yishmael is the best of the bunch. That's already a terrible situation, but okay. Vayikach and he marries Machlas bas Yishmael. Ben Avram, Achos Nevayas, Anashav Lo Lishi. He takes another wife called Machlas, as if to say, my father doesn't like the daughters of Canaan, so he sent Yaakov away, so I guess I can also do something in that way. And it seems to be a direct result of what just happened. So what's very interesting about this? The Shemi Shmuel of Sokachov contemplates this whole situation. And one has to imagine, I mean, this was really a very dark day for Esav. I mean, he literally has been cultivating a relationship with Yitzhak over decades. to be able to get these brachos and that which they represent. And he's just been frustrated at every turn by Yaakov. And one has to imagine, says the Shem Yishmuel, that you know, Yaakov is gone and it's all very quiet now. And Esav just has like this moment of reflection where he wonders, like, why are things not working out for me? What's wrong with me? And he thinks. And thinks a little bit more. And then he realizes, he gets the answer. The answer is nothing. Nothing is wrong with me. Because Esav has been so long in investing in terms of the way that he presents himself, and he wants everyone to think that he's such a wonderful person, so maybe no one else believes him, but he's for sure come to believe that. Esav, actually, and this was really part of his nisayon, Esav comes from the word asui. It means he kind of came out ready-made, and therefore he has this ongoing feeling that he's perfect. And he wants everyone else to think he's perfect. But except being perfect doesn't work out with things not going your way. So why are things not going my way if I'm perfect? That's a good shaila. The answer is very simple. I'm married to the wrong woman. That's it. That's the only thing it can be. And in a sense, the tragedy here, that this is why it's such a tragic final pasuk, is that the moment of introspection, Esau really never looked inside. He's saying, given that I'm perfect, so that's done. What's wrong with me? He looks at his wives. He doesn't even get rid of them. He just takes another one, who's relatively better. But really, he had this one opportunity to think as to maybe there's something in his life that needs correcting. But the only thing he can conclude is that there's something about his wives that needs correcting. And woe to the person who thinks that way. And when in doubt, get married again. And he can stockpile as many wives as he wants, and nothing will change, and he'll never know why. And that's really why the parsha ends in this way. And it's really, of course, a lesson. No one's like Esav, but that notion that it's so much easier to ascribe any setback to instantly locate something outside of the person. But that's Esav's way of looking at things, and Yaakov doesn't. Observe things in that way, and that's not the legacy of Avram as well. So these are some observations and comments and discussions with regards to matters of Parshas Toldos. Mitzvah Hashem, we will meet up with Yaakov next week as he's on the way to Laban's house.